Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. The first LQ update I have is regarding the LQ Radio OGG RSS feed. Now, as you know, from day one, we've supported OGG at LQ Radio. In fact, every audio release we've ever done at LQ Radio has been released in both MP3 and OGG formats. Now, that being said, the RSS feed for podcatchers has only offered the enclosure in MP3 format. And as I announced a couple weeks ago, we're now offering an OGG feed in addition to that MP3 feed, and the link's right on the LQ Radio homepage. So in that 2 weeks, a full 5% or so of subscribers have already moved over. And if you're subscribed to the MP3 feed and are able to use the OGG feed, I'd encourage you to move over to the unencumbered format at your leisure, of course. And just to make sure and to clarify, we are committed to supporting both formats long term, but if you can use OGG at a show like this, obviously that's something that we would encourage. While on the topic of LQ Radio, I have been getting more and more feedback about the audio quality of the podcast. Now, interestingly, some people seem to think it's too loud, and some people seem to think it's too quiet. We are continually working on the quality, and I would like as much feedback as I can get on this subject, so you can feel free to either post a comment or send me an email directly. But what I'd need to know is whether you think it's too quiet or too loud, any specifics you might have. But since we are always trying to tweak kind of the settings, do make sure that you give us the exact podcast that you downloaded, and also whether it was the MP3 or OGG versions. And from there, hopefully with your feedback, we can improve the audio quality and make it as good as it can possibly be. And just an additional note on that, in the coming months, we do have some procedures we're going to change that should hopefully improve it even beyond that. But like I said, your feedback can help us improve it as quickly as possible. The next LQ update I have is in about 2 or 3 hours, actually, I'll be getting on a plane to go to LA to go to Scale, which is the Southern California Area Linux Expo. Last year was my first Scale, and it's an absolutely fantastic show. If you're able to come, I highly recommend it. It's going to be this Saturday and Sunday. I'll be there all day, both days, so if you're going to be there, either drop me an email or leave a comment on the LQ Radio site, and if you'd like to meet up, just let me know where. Additionally, on the other coast, the East Coast, if you'll be at the Open Solutions Summit, which is Wednesday and Thursday of next week, I'll be on the Ask the Experts panel, and if you're going to be there, once again, either shoot me an email or feel free to leave a comment on the LQ Radio site if you'd like to meet up. This is a new show, so it's not something that I've ever been to, but it is an IDG Linux World event, and those typically are very, very good, and they're ones that I highly recommend you try to attend. Now, on to the news. The first story I have is how to tell the open source winners from the losers. And that was a question asked in a recent Information Week article. The article covers a variety of topics and is definitely worth reading if you head over to the Information Week site, but I'll cover a couple of highlights here. Quote, there are 139,834 open source projects underway on SourceForge, the popular open source hosting site. 5 years from now, only a handful of these projects will be remembered for making lasting contributions. Most will remain in niches, unnoticed by the rest of the world. For every Linux, Apache, or MySQL, dozens of other open source efforts fizzle out. That's a dilemma for many companies that are expanding their use of open source. Corporate developers and other IT professionals must get better at divining the winners and ignoring the losers. The wrong picks can lead companies down a rat hole of support problems and obsolete software. End quote. I find that last sentence to be a very interesting one. I can't tell you the number of times I've seen companies in trouble because a proprietary vendor either went out of business or just simply stopped releasing a product. With open source, at least you always have options. Also, a couple of notes I want to give on my perspective on their SourceForge comments. The majority of really huge, and for example, the actual components of the LAMP stack, say, don't usually use SourceForge these days. Some very, very popular projects still do, but after those, I've always broken the rest of the tail, let's call it, into a couple of different categories. There are the new apps that are legitimately just getting off the ground, and it's not that they're not popular, or going to be popular at least, it's just that they're not popular yet. And then there's the apps that are legitimately either abandoned or are just kind of junk. There is another interesting group, though. the apps that are genuinely useful and work very well, but are extremely specific in nature. These are the apps that address a really, really small niche or, say, control a really obscure piece of hardware. So while the downloads on these may not be huge from a sheer raw numbers perspective, in their own context, I'd consider them huge successes. And that's a category of apps you really just don't see in the proprietary world. Another quote from the article, "No community, no project." Many think of an open source quote-unquote community as a passel of unpaid developers who code because they love it. But that's not the driving force behind most of the work. In general, only a small group is allowed to modify or submit changes to source code. Other developers submit code to these core developers. But most important for companies assessing the health of a project is the size and motivation of the group of users hammering away on the code and identifying what's wrong with it and how the project responds to that input. An active community is part of what set Apache apart in the mid-1990s from other freeware, of which IT managers were rightfully wary, says Apache founder Brian Bellendorf. Instead of a site packed with free code at apache.org, potential business users found the code as it was being developed, with comments being exchanged on recent work. It was easy to ask questions, to sign up for the mailing list, to see the long conversational threads on support questions, he says. Bellendorf is describing the transparency that still marks any vibrant open source project. A community needs to be measured by its activity and transparency as much as by its size. The reason for decisions must be clear, with threads of discussion in forums leading up to them, and negative and positive comments getting their airing. That's one of open source's most powerful ingredients. End quote. Obviously, I think community is absolutely vital to the success of open source apps. And I honestly just don't think enough can be said about that. A lot of how the community runs, though, comes down to one of the other points that they make. And this is also from the article. Quote, "MySQL, Linux, and other successful open source projects all have this in common, a Linus Torvald sort of figure, a benevolent dictator with the humility to see the value in other people's work. At JBoss, it was Mark Fleury. At MySQL, it's a pair of developers, Monty Wadeness and David Axmark, who produced the early versions of MySQL and selected the smooth Martin Mikos as CEO. Ross Mason is the undisputed development leader of Mule, an enterprise service bus gaining traction at financial institutions. Mason's also the founder of MuleSource, the company behind it. At Samba, founded in 1992 to provide file and print capabilities across Windows, Unix, and Linux, it's the diplomatic yet decisive Jeremy Allison." End quote. So while it's possible to make it as an open source project without one of these so-called benevolent dictators, it's much, much more difficult. And in the end, it's really almost a component of the community if you have that benevolent dictator. And you need one that not only keeps things running smoothly, but also provides guidance and really a long-term vision, which is key to any open source project. Another benefit is that a well-respected leader is also able to diffuse the tenuous situations that will inevitably rise up. And to use the Linux kernel just as an example, there's often been, on a technical level, arguments that both sides think they're right in the end, but when Linus makes a decision, he's well-respected enough that the group who he went against in the decision realizes that it really is a technical decision, they don't hold it against him or the project, and everything really just keeps going very, very smoothly, especially when you consider how many really smart people are involved. Moving on, the article also points out that things like innovation, luck, and even timing are also huge pieces to this puzzle. And while obviously I don't agree with everything in the article, in the end, I do think their 9-point checklist for how to spot a successful open source project is fairly accurate, at least in the commercial open source space. And here are the 9. A thriving community, disruptive goals, a benevolent dictator, transparency, civility, documentation, employed developers, a clear license, and commercial support. And while your company, if you are evaluating commercial open source, should look further than that list and should always, always download the actual code and get into it to thoroughly evaluate it, the above really is a good anecdotal starting point. So how does the open source software that you are evaluating stack up? The next story I have is the contradictory nature of OOXML Part 2. And this is ongoing coverage of a story that I've been covering quite a bit on the podcast. And once again, Andy continues his excellent coverage of the OOL XML ISO process. and this is a post from his blog from a couple days ago. Quote, "In that first blog entry, I concluded that Microsoft had won the first point in this contest over whether its document format would become a global standard or not. With the deadline passed, who would be found to have won the next round? Well, the results are in, and an unprecedented 19 countries, and he later updated that to 20 by adding Italy, have responded during the contradictions phase, most or all lodging formal contradictions with the JTC, the ISO-IEC body that is managing the fast-track process under which OOXML, which is now the ECMA 376, has been submitted. This may not only be the largest number of countries that have ever submitted contradictions, but 19, and actually 20 now, responses is greater than the total number of national bodies that often bother to even vote on a proposed standard at all. When it is recalled that any national body responding would first have to had to wade through the entire 6,039 pages of the specification itself, and then compose, debate, and approve its response in only 30 days, this result is nothing less than astonishing. Truly, I think that this demonstrates the degree to which the world has come to appreciate the importance of ensuring the long-term accessibility of its historical record, as well as the inadvisability of entrusting that heritage to a single vendor or software program." End quote. Also on his blog, a post before that is pretty in-depth coverage of what actually constitutes a contradiction, and that's a good read. I myself wasn't actually sure, and that post did clear up quite a bit for me. So if you're following this, I highly recommend you head over to his blog. So I'd say that this level of response, especially in such a short time frame, is quite telling. It remains to be seen, however, how Microsoft will respond, but I think the writing is definitely on the wall. The world governments have learned that being beholden to a single vendor is just bad practice. Now, in somewhat related news to this, a quote from yet another one of Andy's blogs, quote, "But while this global drama has been playing out, I've learned that a third U.S. state is considering requiring use of open document formats by government agencies. Massachusetts and Minnesota are the other two to date. That state is Texas, where a bill has been introduced to require that only open document formats should be permitted. The bill is designated SB 446 and was filed on February 5th. How does a Texas bill define an open document format? As stated in the bill, such a format would need to be based on extensible markup language, would need to have been previously approved, and would be required to meet the following criteria. 1. Interoperable amongst diverse internal and external platforms and applications. 2. Published without restrictions or royalties. 3. Fully and independently implemented by multiple software providers on multiple platforms without any intellectual property reservations for necessary technology. And 4. Controlled by an open industry organization with a well-defined, inclusive process for evolution of the standard." End quote. While a couple of those requirements are a bit nebulous, especially with regard to definition of certain terms, such as what really constitutes diverse and things like that, number 3 is not nebulous and would certainly be a death knell for the use of OOXML. I'm going to have to follow this bill, and I'm sure quite a few people will be seeing how it does as it makes its way through the legal process. It should also be interesting to see if any additional states will follow the lead of these 3. The last story I have is, what if hardware vendors are trapped too? And this was a post from Chromatic's blog about hardware vendors providing open drivers and even more ideally open specifications. This is a topic I've covered quite a bit of before on the podcast. In his post, he goes through a variety of reasons you'll often see from vendors, and then he gives his counterpoint to each one. His conclusion sums it up very well though. Quote, "Unfortunately, the best choice is not to buy such hardware when possible. It's often a question of pragmatism versus exponents, where short-term benefits mask long-term problems. That's often not possible, especially when buying specialized hardware or devices with difficult-to-replace components such as laptops. However, it's clear that the normal approach, that is, complaining in small groups and rewarding vendors with your business anyway, is not working. Nor does reverse engineering drivers address the root of the problem. It's valuable in that it mitigates the damage, but it does little to prevent further problems. Acknowledging vendors with the courage to deal with their customers respectfully and honestly may help. free and open source software advocates can do a much better job of praising honest efforts to work with communities and to encourage other companies to do so in a mutually beneficial way. The ultimate long-term answer is continued work to produce actual and lasting reform of legal systems that reward information hoarding to dangerous extremes. This change will only occur with focused and directed action from the people affected. This means you. Have you shared your concerns about software patents with your legal representative lately? However, if you like software patents and DRM that prevent fair use, then now is time for very quiet reflection. It's unfortunate that the acts of a few dedicated individuals and companies have so punished both vendors and their customers. Instead of casting aspersions on each other, perhaps working together for common interests will both increase the market for high-quality hardware from trustworthy vendors and provide free and open-source communities with open and redistributable drivers and specifications. End quote. And he's absolutely right here on multiple levels. And if this is a topic that interests you, I definitely recommend you head over to Chromatic's blog and read the whole post. We should absolutely be doing a better job of dealing with vendors with the courage to deal with their customers respectfully and honestly, and it really is courage at this point in the game, at least in my opinion. Beyond that, though, fixing a very broken legal system is certainly the long-term answer, which means the question becomes, what's the best way to make that happen in as much of an expeditious manner as we can? And there's probably no one specific answer to that. But generally speaking, focused and directed action also seems like the best course to me. So, if you have a few free moments today, why not take action yourself? And what you do, I'll leave up to you, but do something, because in the end, it's up to all of us. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening. And if you'll be in either LA or New York City, see you at Scale or the Linux World Open Solutions Summit.